The BBC presents My Word. And here to introduce the program and the panel is Jack Longland.
My Word is a word game played by people whose business is words, and those taking part are Dillis Powell, Nancy Spain, Frank Muir, and Dennis Norton. This is round one to test their vocabulary. 2 marks if they get the meanings of these words reasonably right. Beginning with you, Dillis. Dillis Powell, what is the meaning of desideratum?
Something which is desired or wished for.
Yep, that's good enough. Something which is missing, a want that is felt, something that you regret the absence of, desideratum. 2 marks. Dennis Norton, the meaning of the word Ruth, R-U-T-H.
Not the name.
No.
Shame. Well, it's one of those sort of half-words that you only hear in connection with a prefix or suffix, like,
yes,
you know, like ept. You never hear somebody ept, they're always inept. Or couth, you know. People are always uncouth. You never hear people being ruth. They're always ruthless.
Yes.
We're getting there, aren't we?
Yes, you are.
When they're ruthless, they're pitiless.
Yes, that's it.
That's it.
Well, except the first half of that.
So it's the first half of that. It's pity.
Pity. Ruth is pity, or compassion. 2 marks. And that is bad. What is a siffleur? S-I-F-F-L-E-U-R. Siffleur.
Oh, Lorks, it's something you blow through, Jack.
No.
No? Not one of those little tubes you have for fixing the... Well, it's a whistler, then.
That's it.
Yes.
It's a whistler who does it professionally and appears on the stage and you pay him. Frank Muir, what is a rum-tum? R-U-M-T-U-M. Rum-tum.
A rum-tum? Well, it's one-third of something, of which the latter two-thirds is tiddle-tiddle-lum-tum. It's also a minor state of ill health. Beyond that, I hesitate to go, Jack.
Well,
is it Greek?
No, I should take to the water, if I were you, Frank. Well, I don't mean as opposed to the drink.
A rum tum, but sailors drinking rum and getting a curious tum. Is that...
No, I've done my best.
It's a boat.
It's a boat. You've got there at last. What kind of boat?
What kind of boat? But don't just say boat.
Round one.
A round one?
I don't know.
A boat, a kind of boat, Jack.
1 out of 2. It's a light sculling boat used on the Lower Thames. Before we start the next round, round two, I now give each team a quotation, which they can write down if they want, and then I want the 2 women members of the team, after study of their quotations, to tell me at the end of the program the source of their particular quotation. And Dillis Powell, with Frank Muir listening in, your quotation is, "Oh, what a beautiful morning." And Nancy Spain, with Dennis, your quotation is, "Roll on, thou deep and dark blue ocean." And then at the end of the program, I shall ask Frank and Dennis to give me their ideas of how these words came to be said or written. And I don't want any of these answers yet. And so to the next round, which is origins and derivations. 2 marks if you can tell me the present-day meaning of the following words or expressions, and 2 more if you can tell me how they originated. Dillis Powell, yours is hooligan.
Hooligan?
Hmm.
Hooligan means a delinquent chap, a very rough one.
Mm-hmm. Where would you find him?
Practically anywhere.
Ireland.
You mustn't look at the audience.
Is it Irish?
Is it Irish?
Right.
Irish, no.
Yes. No, I think there is 2 marks. It means one of a gang of street roughs or toughs and a violent troublemaker. And it was in London at the end of the 19th century because of the activities of a spirited Irish family of the name of Hooligan or Hoolihan, who enlivened the pretty drab, monotonous life in Southwark at that time. At least that's what they say. Two out of four.
It's nice to know.
Dennis Norton. Moonraker.
Moonraker's the novel by Ian Fleming.
Yep.
I think the origin is something about a pond where some people tried to saw the reflection of the moon in the pond and they tried to scoop it up.
Yes.
Wise men of Gotham.
The wise men of Gotham.
I think Nancy is misleading you, but because the first part... the first part is absolutely right, Dennis.
Sorry?
Yes. Mm. I think it's like some rural difference that took place somewhere.
That's right. Which county?
I'm not going to put my neck out by saying any county then proving to be wrong. Obviously, it's a term of abuse.
They make very good hams there, too.
Do they? Do you say it, Jack? You can take the
count. All right, well, two out of four... Dennis's explanation of the story is quite right. It was supposed to have been in Wiltshire because some Wiltshire rustic saw the reflection of the moon in a pond and did try to rake it out. And so a moonraker is, impolitely, a native of Wiltshire. In Wiltshire, they have a quite different story, that the men were raking a pond for kegs of smuggled brandy, and they put off the revenue officer who was there by pretending to be mad and to be raking up the moon. Two out of four. Nancy Spain. Namby-pamby.
It means a milksop or muff.
Yes. And originates how?
Well, it's one of these rhyming things.
No,
it's a sound, surely.
Yes, it is, indeed, yes. Namby-pamby.
Sort of, it's a kind of a petulant wailing sounds. It's onomatopoeic.
Yes.
It has no origination. You just...
Like
man was casting for a word at one time. So you're just namby-pamby.
He did do it that way, but it had an origin. Well, I think two out of four. It means insipidly pretty or wishy-washy or feeble, sloppy. But it was copied from the name of a chap called Ambrose Phillips, who was a poet, and a dramatist called Harry Carey had read Phillips's verses addressed to the children of his noble patron, Lord Carteret. And he thought they were so silly and childish and stupid that he coined this word namby-pamby, which he thought summed up what he felt about the verses. Frank Muir, knickerbockers.
Well, they're knickers with bockers on the
roughly, yes.
Yes,
they're fine, a little more close.
Knickerbockers, they're long, aren't they? And they're tucked into the socks.
Yes.
Knickerbockers.
Top end of the socks or bottom?
There's no bottom end of the socks. It's got a toe container at the other end. It's impossible to tuck. It's tucked into the top of the socks.
Yes. All right. And how does it originate?
Knickerbocker. It's vaguely New York.
Yes.
New Yorkian,
yes.
Isn't it?
Yes.
The Knickerbocker building. And Cholly Knickerbocker. Knickerbocker glory. That's a very loud pair of knickerbockers. It's Edwardian New York.
Earlier than that.
Dutch.
Dutch.
My lady friend here has written Dutch.
I think
It was New Amsterdam,
they
all dashed round in knickerbockers.
You're sort of creeping up, and I think I'll give you 3.5 out of 4 now. These are loose-fitting breeches gathered in below the knee. When abbreviated from knickerbocker to knicker, or knickers, it's a little different, though they were still used to be gathered in somewhere, I believe. And they were originally named from a book written by Washington Irving, who pretended to be a chap called Knickerbocker, who wrote Knickerbocker's History of New York. And all the illustrations showed... Oh, tough characters wearing very loose knee breeches. But Frank's quite right in saying that in the singular, a knickerbocker is a New Yorker of original Dutch descent. So I think he deserves his 3.5 marks. Next round is a quickie. I want to know who wrote the following famous books. 1 mark each time, if you get it. Phyllis Powell, The Mill on the Floss.
George Eliot.
Yes, a mark. Dennis Norden, The Call of the Wild.
Jack London.
Yes. Nancy Spain, Old St. Paul's.
Harrison Ainsworth.
Quite right. 1 mark. And Frank Muir, Jude the Obscure.
William... Thomas... we should write more clearly. Thomas... Thomas Hardy.
Yes, quite right. And then the next round is the who, where, why, and what department. 2 marks each time. Tell us, Powell, where was John Gilpin going when he set out on the famous ride which was immortalized in Cooper's poem?
The Bell.
Yes. And where was that?
In London.
All right. The pub that he was riding towards was the Bell, but it was at Edmonton, a bit outside London in those days.
Suburb.
Tomorrow is our wedding day, and we will then repair unto the Bell at Edmonton, all in a chaise and pair. That's what his wife told him, but he had to ride on a horse. Dennis Norden, what did the owl and the pussycat dine on, and how did they eat it?
They ate it with a runcible spoon.
Yes.
They dined on him and him, didn't they?
Yeah.
They dined on mince and slices of quince.
Which they ate
with a runcible spoon.
Quite right. The owl and the pussycat dined on mince and slices of quince, which they ate with a runcible spoon. And hand in hand on the edge of the sand, they danced by the light of the moon.
The moon.
That's it. Edward Lear. 2 marks. Nancy Spain. I doubt it, said the carpenter, and shed a bitter tear. What did he doubt that caused him to weep?
If 7 maids with 7 mops could sweep it for half a year.
Yes.
Do you suppose, the walrus said, that they could sweep it clear? I doubt it, said the carpenter, and shed a bitter tear.
What were they sweeping?
The Strand.
Yes.
The walrus and the carpenter were walking hand in hand. They wept like anything to see such...
Yes, this is the bit I want.
Sand.
Yes, that's it. They didn't like the amount of sand they found on the beach.
No.
And that was why they shed a bitter tear, and they doubted if 7 maids with 7 mops could sweep it all away. That right? 2 marks. Lewis Carroll through the looking glass. Frank Muir, who admitted that he was possessed of very little brain and that long words bothered him?
Dennis?
Sneak.
Yes. Ah. No. Who? Very little brain.
I am a of very little brain, and long words bother me.
You're of very little brain. Was it a George?
No, it wasn't a George. It's Winnie the Pooh.
Samuel Coleridge.
Winnie the Pooh, or just plain Pooh, who said, I am a bear of very little brain, and long words bother me, in A.A. Milne's Winnie the Pooh. No marks. And now we come to the last round, and go back to those quotations I gave the two teams earlier on in the program. For 2 marks, Dillis Powell, can you give me the origin of your quotation, Oh, What a Beautiful Morning?
It's the first line of the first song in Oklahoma.
By?
Rodgers and Hammerstein.
Quite right. 2 marks. Rodgers and Hammerstein's song out of Oklahoma. Now, Nancy Spain, the origin of your quotation, which was, Roll on, thou deep and dark blue ocean.
Well, it's by Lord Byron.
Yes.
I like the stage direction which comes after it in brackets. It rolls on.
The name poem?
Well, it's always Charlie Howell.
Yes. And it goes, Roll on, thou deep and dark blue ocean, roll, 10,000 fleets sweep over thee in vain. 2 marks. And now I'm going to ask Frank and Dennis to give me their explanations of how these quotations came into being. And on this occasion, the marks will go to whichever incredible explanation receives the longer or louder amount of applause from the audience here in the studio. So back to Frank Muir and his quotation, Oh, What a Beautiful Morning.
It was a hot day on the beach at Broadstairs. I was lying stretched out on the sand, 6'5" of me, my toes pointing towards the dappled water, my head pointed towards the glinting white cliffs. I should have been happy, but I wasn't. I was only 12 years old. And when you're 12 years old and you're 6'5" tall, problems arise. I was rather a shy lad, and I was in love. I'd been in love before. I'd been deeply in love before, many times, that morning. But I suddenly saw the girl who was made for me. She was sitting on top of the steps leading from the beach, in a cotton dress, with a wet bathing costume flung carelessly round her shoulders, and she was cleaning tar from the sole of her foot with the used stick of a toffee apple. I made inquiries about her. I found her name was Mabel Leatherbarrow. She was known as Nobby. Nobby, I didn't dare speak to. How could I? 6'5" in length, and almost no width at all. I was too embarrassed to speak to anybody. I'd never spoken to a girl in my life. And when anybody spoke to me, curious things happen. My hands went very large and heavy and red, and I could feel them terribly heavy at the end of my very long arms. And my ears used to go very hot. So what I used to do when anybody spoke to me is I used to wind my right leg around my left leg. I could get it round about 1 3/4 turns and then flail around a bit with these huge hot hands in order to keep my balance and hope the people would go away. So I obviously couldn't tackle Mabel Leatherbarrow with my love. Then my mother said to me, "You'd better get cleaned up because we're going to a wedding. Do you know the Leatherbarrows? Only the brother's getting married this afternoon." Immediately I thought, this is the chance. Perhaps I should be near my beloved. 2 hours I spent on my toilette. I washed my neck very carefully with lots of soap, so much so that it damped the collar of my jacket. And I polished my shoes on the dog's ear. And away we went to church, and I sat next to Mabel. Oh, it was wonderful. I didn't dare even look at her. But then I had an inspiration. I felt in my pocket, and I had a bit of stick jaw. Do you remember that black treacle stick jaw, which I was saving in case there was a sermon? And I passed it to Mabel, and for one blissful moment, our fingers touched. It was more than a moment, actually, because the stuff was rather sticky. It was rather hot in the pocket. And her eyes smiled thanks at me. And I was in love. My heart shattered like a snowball through a car rear window. And I was in love. And I came away, and I went back to my room, and I wondered how I could tell Mabel. And I realized that I was far too shy to speak. So I put it down on paper. I wrote her a poem. I got my... in brown ink, which I was affecting at the time. I wrote her the poem, and the following morning I waited outside her house, and as she came out, I stopped her and I thrust the poem, mute, I thrust the poem in her hand, my right leg curled round my left, my huge hands went red and dangled, made my arms ache with their weight, and my ears burned so much I could feel my solidified brilliantine melting down my neck and running into the salt cellars of my shoulder. And she read the poem, and I remember every word of the poem. I'd written, "Oh, what a pew I sat in with you when your elder brother Harry and the girl from the ironmongers did marry. But in that pew my heart did pound and pound, for everlasting love at last I'd found. Return my passion, dear, or heed my warning. Till I do die, my heart will wear full mourning." And she read the poem through, and I waited for a comment. And when it came, she said, "It's soppy, isn't it?" And I'd achieved 3 firsts. It was the first time I then spoke to a girl. It was the first time I'd spoken to a girl. It was the first time I'd known the bitterness of unrequited love. And it was the first time I'd been hit on the head with adverse literary criticism. She said, "It's soppy, isn't it?" Immediately, my right leg unwound like an egg beater from my left. My hands returned to their normal weight and size. My ears went back to room temperature. I said, "What do you mean, soppy? What's soppy about it? Tell me what's soppy. Go on, which bit's soppy? Come on, I challenge you. Point out which bit's soppy. From where to where is it soppy?" And she told me. She told me which bit was soppy. You know which bit it was? It was soppy, she said, from "Oh, what a pew" to "full morning."
I've been watching Frank's ears throughout that story, and I'm happy to announce he's completely conquered his disability. And we pass on to Dennis Norden, and his quotation, if you remember, was, "Roll on, thou deep and dark blue ocean."
I don't know if any of you knew Lord Byron's first wife. I didn't expect so, actually, because the marriage didn't last very long. How could he ever marry a girl like Arabella Tunnicliffe? Or Tunnicliffe, actually, because she was a North Country girl. How Byron came to... the only presumption is that it was her very simplicity, her lack of sophistication, which attracted him, but he thought perhaps he might resolve his difficulties with her. And anyway, they married, and they set out on a honeymoon to, of course, his beloved Greek islands. It didn't go very well on the boat. It started off badly. For one thing, she liked deck games. And that wasn't Byron. He much preferred being below and knocking out another couple of stanzas of Childe Harold, but she wouldn't have it. She kept saying, "Come upstairs, Byrie." Now, I mean, Byrie. He had three Christian names, this chap, but she called him Byrie. She said, "Come up." She said, you can make up your recitations up here." It was at moments like this that he had this feeling which psychiatrists have never been able to define, but which can be roughly translated as, "What am I doing here with this slob?" I think the first real moment of truth came when Greece was sighted. Remember, the mountains look down on Marathon and Marathon looks at the sea. He called to her and he said, "Gaze ahead, my dear. You see those mountains with the white on top? That's Greece." She said, "Well, it..." I was going to say, she said, "It looks like snow." Something stabbed him to the heart then, but he persevered. He took her ashore to Greece, but it was no good. What can you do with a person who wants to play French cricket in the Acropolis? Then the realization came upon him, which can only be summed up as, "She'll have to go." But then he thought, "No, it may be my fault. We are in Greece. And here the old Greek gods still hold dominion." He remembered a thing which is very strong among Greeks. It's called hubris. It's a thing that has demanded that human happiness depends upon a human acknowledging that he's mortal. And they do this, the Greeks, by throwing a beloved possession into the sea in order to show the gods that they acknowledge their mortality. So he went back to the boat with her and he tried to explain it. He tried to explain it to Arabella, and she said, "It's downright extravagance. That's..." He said, "Look," and he, taking off a jeweled ring, he flung it into the sea, shouting, "Jewelry, thou wine-red sea." And she said, "Lord Byron, you must be doolally. That thing must have cut..." "It might be easy for you to make your brass, but it isn't where we..." He said, "Please, Arabella, you throw something that you treasure." She said, "I'll not." He said, "The necklace." "The necklace that were given me by my gran." He said, "Well, something that is close to you." She said, "I'll give you something that's close to me." And reaching into her wardrobe, she brought out an object. He blenched. She said, "There's not more close to me than this." It was a roll-on. Something flickered in Byron's eyes, and with one deft twist of the wrist, he overboarded her. Well, of course, he was tried for the crime, but luckily it was a Greek court, and he explained to them that he could not stand this insult to the land of Homer. And on this explanation, he was acquitted on the grounds of what they call justifiable homicide over there. Of course, he set sail back to England immediately, and on the voyage back, he took care to throw overboard everything that would ever remind him of Arabella Tunnicliffe again, every one of her belongings, till finally he stood with this one sole offending garment, this one thing that had brought such an early close to the short tenure of their marriage. And he thought this must go as well. So to the dark gods of Homer beyond the sea, he threw it overboard with the cry, "Roll on, thou deep and dark blue ocean."
Well, I think by your vote, Dennis Norden's story wins, and that brings us to a final score in which both teams tie, which is pretty rare, and it also brings to an end this edition of My Word.
In My Word, you heard Dilys Powell, Nancy Spain, Frank Muir, and Dennis Norden, introduced by Jack Longland. The program was devised by Tony Shryan and Edward J. Mason and presented by the BBC.